Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour session of Zero Point Radio on BBS Radio. It is the 30th of May, 2009. The main focus of the Zero Point show is on mystical and spiritual psychology and science, and we cover a wide variety of topics, especially the issues of consciousness, the nature of the human soul, esoteric teachings about metaphysics, and I attempt to relate ancient ideas about creation to the most recent ideas in modern physics and science. That's been my lifelong passion, has been the study of consciousness because of being a psychologist and interested in psychotherapy. And traditionally in psychology, they always distinguished between the conscious and the unconscious and had a dualistic approach to consciousness studies. But 30 years ago, I began by studying the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching and then a wide variety of other esoteric teachings over the last 30 years, trying to understand this issue of the nature of human consciousness. About 2.5 years ago, my youngest son showed me the movie Loose Change. And although I'd seen the attacks on New York City when they occurred, I was actually working in a prison in Canada at the time as a psychologist, and I watched it with my dorm of men, and we were all kind of stunned and aghast as the tragedy unfolded that day. And afterwards, I guess I got so caught up in my busy life that it was years I didn't even realize that there was any controversy about the 9/11 attacks. I assumed what the media told us, that it was Osama bin Laden and 19 radical Muslims who hated American freedom and so on and so forth. And I bought it whole hook, line, and sinker. Until I watched that movie, Loose Change, and on viewing that, I immediately realized, obviously, we've been lied to. And that movie, Loose Change, I think there's much about it which is misleading, especially in terms of what I've learned since. But at least if you watch that movie, you realize, oh, a hoax has been perpetrated. We've been deceived about what happened that day, and no one has seriously made an effort to uncover the truth. And the implications of it, it's not... See, in Canada, people would say, oh, well, that's in the United States. It's not really our business, and so on and so forth. But that's really not true. Because now Canada has also become involved in this war in Afghanistan, which is a completely illegal and criminal war. And our government in Canada has lied and deceived the Canadian public and deceived the military itself. And there's this big war on terrorism going on, but there's absolutely no effort to capture the real terrorists. Because whoever did 9/11 is a group of terrorists. But it wasn't Osama bin Laden and his reindeer. That just isn't what happened. So once you begin to wake up to the horrors of the situation, it in a way gets worse and worse. You realize the complicity of the media and how they've intentionally deceived the public. You realize how in the States, the CIA and the FBI and CSA and all your alphabet soup of all your agencies, none of them are seriously capturing the terrorists who committed that act. In fact, all our judiciaries and police, they all protect the criminals. And it's like an overwhelming situation. And the same in Canada. In Canada now, we just had Bush and Clinton visit, and the RCMP are out there protecting the war criminals when they come to Canada. This great big lie. It's like we in Western civilization, we live a great big lie. You know, with the lie of democracy, the lie of an honest media, the lie that the public is truly informed, the lie that the government protects our health. and more you learn, the more and more terrible it becomes. Fortunately, the truth movement has grown around the world, and people are beginning to wake up to the realities of all the lies we've been told, not just about 9/11, but now so much truth has come out about all kinds of other events which have occurred, which have never been meaningfully investigated. And I really think back mainly to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, one of the beloved president of the United States, who an inspired man who I think was loved by people around the world. And that tragic day, you think you had a president of his stature, even though Kennedy himself had his failings and so on. But you realize that here is an assassination of the president of the United States, and no one ever got to the root of it. And all these agencies are complicit in preventing people from learning the truth. It's like the police no longer protect and serve the public. They protect and serve these criminal elite who have taken over our countries. And it's not just in the United States. It's in Canada, Israel, England. You could probably name every country in the world, and it's ruled by some type of group of criminal psychopaths and people who really don't have the will or care of the populace in their hearts. If I look around the world, Chavez in Venezuela seems one leader to me who I reserve judgment on, thinking that he may be a man really serving the people of Venezuela, even though it's hard to say. And our media portrays such a tainted image of him that it's really hard to know the truth. So it is pretty discouraging and shocking to wake up to the reality of what's become of Western civilization. If you go to my website, up at the top, I have a link to a song, Where is the Love, by Black Eyed Peas. And I play that song over and over again, like, where is the love? How could people do this? How could people murder people around the world based on lies, just so that the rich can be, the billionaires can have more billions of people, of dollars and wealth and power? They care nothing for the populace. The governments, they lie to us in almost every aspect of our societies. The healthcare system, the pharmaceutical mafia that runs our medical system, the inventions which have been suppressed. So many ills have fallen upon Western society and so now there's this, I think, worldwide struggle of people waking up to the reality and the truth of what's occurred and trying to take our governments and nations back. So I've never in my life been a politically oriented person. I'm a psychologist, and I was a professor of psychology for 12 years, and I worked in prisons for 12 years, and last years I've devoted to working up my writing and my Zero Point website. But when I woke up to this all, I have since become involved in politics. I'm almost 60 years old, and I don't like politics. I never did. But it's like, what else can one do? What can we do to oppose these satanic forces that have taken over our societies? And I guess I try to contribute through my website and my writing up on my website and through these radio shows on BBS. And then I joined what's called the Canadian Action Party. So today, a week or so ago, I wrote up a brief summary of existing CAP standing for Canadian Action Party. I wrote up a summary of CAP policies, and I'm going to kind of go through those today. And then through the second half of the show, I want to open the lines up and invite people to call in to comment upon what CAP's existing policies are And if you have any recommendations for us, because we're a fledgling political party, we're very poor, we have none of the kind of corporate support that all the mainstream parties have. But at least I found with CAP that it's what I would call a truth party. And I think you'll see that as I go through the policies. So I'm going to put that off for a moment and introduce my co-host. I live up by Ottawa, Ontario, and my co-host, James Moffat, is in Toronto. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, a little tired today. I was up early, took some relatives out to a dandelion festival and just got home and didn't have time to kind of settle in here. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I felt down lately. Generally, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's overwhelming a little bit, just all the kind of deviancy and the helplessness I feel in the face of it all.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I have a kind of a much different sort of reaction to it. I mean, I'm not as surprised, I think, as you are by it all. I guess maybe I've been sort of more, you know, it's not terribly shocking to me any of this, you know, the revelations about things. It just like I've had a lot more practice. Yeah, I think, you know, so I'm kind of I don't feel as I don't feel things are quite as dismal as perhaps you do. But at the same time, I mean, I think what you're saying is legitimate. I certainly don't dispute that. I have more of a withdrawal from it. It's funny because I feel kind of up right now. So the last little while, but more because I've been reading quite a bit of material on mystical teachings from a variety of sources, and just sort of I mentioned to you I've been reading David Lorimer's book on the near-death experience called Whole in One, the near-death experience and the ethic of interconnectedness, which is a very interesting book, like quite a lot of interesting material on the near-death experience itself, and then he has quite a comprehensive grasp of religious and mystical traditions, and it provides a very good exposition of certain ideas in those traditions and how it really relates to the experience of the near-death experience, how it parallels the visionary or transcendent or mystical experience, whatever you want to call it, the experience of higher states. So it's quite interesting material. And in addition to that, I was started reading Kenneth Walker, who was a student of both Gurdjieff and Uspensky, reading his book called The Mystic Mind, which is, it's an old book that he wrote about 1965, I guess. And I really like his writing. I think he's very clear. He's also very well schooled and versed. I haven't been actually that impressed by that book, but it's interesting to read. I've also been reading Jeffrey Perinder wrote a book on mysticism and the religious tradition, which is Mysticism and the World's Religions by Jeffrey Perinder, and it's very, very good too, because he gets into the material I think that you'd find very interesting, because he talks about the transcendent and higher states of consciousness and the differences in terms of the religious teachings and interpretations across the great traditions as to what people, how people construe the mystical experience. There are very widespread differences, really, in the explanation as to what's actually happening. Although, I think to a certain extent, that's imposed, and he says this himself, I think that's imposed culturally and by certain times that certain things become emphasized or certain things become interpreted in a certain way. So even like, for instance, in the Buddhist tradition, you know, even though the Buddhists don't really speak of a god, he said if you really go back to Buddhist experience and follow through the development of the different schools of Buddhism, it's not even really that clear that Buddha didn't speak of God, which is why I found that very interesting, because that's always one of the things people bring up about the Buddhists is that, well, they don't believe in God, you know, but not so fast.
It's not so simple. I mean, they do believe in reincarnation. I mean,
well, and they say, well, they certainly believe, I mean, so they believe in the void, you know, that I mean, what ultimately I think is so interesting is that you have this commonality of elements, which I think if you extrapolate from them, you can see across the Buddhist or the Kabbalistic or the Hindu or the, you know, any of the major, the Muslim or the Christian traditions, any of the major religious traditions and the various schools of esotericism. Really what people are describing, there's just this remarkable similarity in the experiences. And even though it's like, you know, it's like in science when you have different disciplines focusing on different aspects of the same thing. I mean, physics and chemistry both study the physical world, but they study it in different ways. And I think that parallel holds in the esoteric tradition. There's a different emphasis perhaps in certain traditions, but anyway, so I've been sort of kind of, I've been feeling kind of illuminated and uplifted and inspired by reading this material, because interesting material in Lorimer's book on the doctrine of karma, and I realize that's something that, you know, I've always sort of kind of glossed over, and I've read, you know, I've read people like Lama Govinda on karma, quite an interesting explanation, and I've read some of the Buddhist discussions of it, but it's a very, very complex idea, and I mean, it's so interesting because I was thinking earlier today, in a way, if you contrast the doctrine of karma and the idea that what we are doing in this world has ramifications for ourselves and our future lives and our past lives, and also for others in terms of people that we interact with, I mean, on one level, you might say, well, a skeptic or a rationalist might say, well, that's just such hocus pocus, and you're just making all these assumptions. But really, it's not really any more of a metaphysical jump to an assumption to say that as it is to suggest that the universe arose by accident and random processes, blind, uncoordinated evolution. You know, I mean, it's essentially the same thing in the sense that it does require a leap, an assumptive leap on some level, but the more I kind of read about it, the more I'm interested in just this whole notion. What I found was particularly interesting about this, though, was how do you square, like, what's really interesting to me about karma is that when people have a near-death experience or when people have a transcendent or visionary experience in not by dying, but just by awakening, repeatedly people talk about they have this incredible feeling of the all-rightness of the universe, the justice of things. Now, in light of what happens on the physical plane and in terms of our normal sense-based consciousness interpretation of all the horror that goes on on our planet, it's hard to square that idea. It's hard to square that perception with the idea of on some level the universe being just and all right, because there's so much injustice and suffering in the world. Yeah. So that's what I find. I think that's very interesting. I think this points to you need something like the doctrine of karma to make sense of things in a way. I don't know if I'm explaining that correctly, but I see, like, as I say, in the near-death experience, people, and this is just ordinary people that have this experience of meeting the beings of light and having a life review or having a sense of what their life has meant and what they're going to have to account for. But they go back to life and they no longer fear death, and they have this, Huxley says it about the visionary experience, they have this sense of the essential all-rightness of the universe, that on some level everything is just and is resolved, which is, I think, very profound for us in terms of leading our own lives, is to try to seriously understand what this might mean.
Yeah, at an international and political level, yeah, I agree. Yeah, I was going to say, I think you're right. Like, I think you were much more knowledgeable of historic events and the political scene and that realm than I was, like, for many years. That's why, I mean, I was completely floored when I learned the truth of 9/11. Not that I know the truth of it, but I know it wasn't Osama bin Laden and 19 Muslims.
That is right,
but, you know, I know it's a fraud. Like, that's obvious.
Yeah.
You know, but so I, as you say, like, I think you have more historic perspective. So for, in your eyes, well, it was just one more lie after all the lies of Vietnam, all the lies of Cambodia, all the lies of Central America, all the lies of South America, all the, you know, the lies of the assassinations of Kennedy and then Robert Kennedy and King and all these lies. Like,
it's still a shocking though, because it's just such a blatant, psychotic and, I'm trying to think of what the word, act of depravity, that, you know, that to murder 4,000 or 3,500 people, whatever it was. I mean, you know, it's just, and to think that, you know, your own government was at the very least complicit, which I think there's no doubt that they were, or that they actually, you know, actively engineered this, is just, as you say, for what? You know, but I mean, that these people have a track record of, as we were talking off air with Don, is that some people just feel that they can go around murdering people with impunity to make themselves more rich and powerful, and it doesn't seem to bother them. They're as you say, they're psychopaths. They're what Gurdjieff calls hasnasmus individuals, that they're soulless and they're godless and they're depraved, you know. These are the people that are respectable, quote unquote, and who run things, you know. I mean, it's why I can't take the mainstream political process or the mainstream political coverage or the media. It's just like, you know, I mean, it's like kind of a comic book to me. I just don't, you know, they're pornographers, the media, I think, by and large. I just, in the last few years, I've just sort of really tuned out of what goes on in the mainstream media. I used to be quite, you know, attentive and relatively media savvy, and I still read, you know, the New York Times, and you know, I watch the news or I listen to the radio, but I just step back and I think, you know, it's just another degree of separation for me, in the sense that, like, that's one of the things about being introduced to esoteric teachings, and just specifically to the Gurdjieff idea about that the world is run by people in sleep, and that everyone's asleep, and that it's the only hypothesis that really explains anything properly to me. And when I first encountered that, I thought, oh, okay. Then things began to make sense to me, and so I realized that, you know, that most of what passes for informed discussion is basically lying, like lying as we normally understand it, but also lying in the sense that Gurdjieff means it, about people talking about things that they don't understand and don't know. And so you have this confusion of tongues in which most of the great issues of the day are discussed. As long as you remember that and can put what's said in context, I think you're much farther ahead in terms of understanding what's really going on. You know, I can't buy into most of the explanations of things. And I feel the same way about many of the alternative explanations too. I mean, what so-called truth radio or the truth movement, well, it's like everything else, you know. There are people in it who know what they're talking about, and there's a lot of people that are just bullshitters, that in my mind. I mean, show me the money. I have to see some compelling evidence for many of the hypotheses that explain alternative explanations of things, you know. Like, for instance, like, I mean, in the 9/11 situation, I mean, I have no doubt that the official story is a cover-up and that it's completely bogus. There's no doubt in my mind to that. And I think anybody who looks with an open mind and objectively at the situation and compares the changes even in the official explanations from the beginning, like the changes in what the military said, the sort of concerted effort to arrive at a conclusion, Bush's resistance to forming a commission to investigate, and then the way that the investigation was steered, just as the Warren report was, into the Kennedy assassination. If you follow all of that and you look at it closely, there are just so many holes in the official explanation that I don't think there's any doubt that something quite different happened. Having said that, I don't think that I really know what happened. I mean, I I'm open, you know. I'd love for somebody to explain to me what really happened to make a really compelling case. But
yeah.
Until people really open up and dig into it more, like in the sense that until there's more of an uncovering of all the secrecy that surrounds us and all the information that's been classified. I mean, it'll be years probably before things will be declassified that will shed light. I mean, this is happening in the Kennedy assassination, you know, 45 years later. We're still learning things because documents have become declassified, and it's providing a more comprehensive picture. But until that happens, and I think we can really get to the bottom of what really happened here. But as you say, in your opening comments, the ramifications of this worldwide for all the so-called Western democracies is like they've all been caught up in fighting this war on terror, which is a completely phony war, and it's really nothing more than an excuse for the military-industrial complex in the United States to secure its position and to enforce American imperial power all over the globe, and for us to go along as their faithful doggy allies, you know. So we have to send people to die in Afghanistan for what, you know? I mean, 10 years from now, I guarantee you, 10 years from now, Canada won't be fighting in Afghanistan. The United States probably won't be fighting there. And people will look back and say, well, what exactly did those people die for?
After Vietnam.
Yeah,
I mean, 50,000 American soldiers
yeah,
were killed
for what?
There. And,
yeah,
yeah
you
for
know,
what? You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's my perspective on it. I mean, I would argue in Vietnam that the United States was not fighting for democracy, that if you really look at the history of Vietnam, they were fighting against democracy because Ho Chi Minh would have been elected if there had been free and open elections. Ho Chi Minh would have been elected the president of the United Vietnam.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was a nationalist and a communist was why he couldn't be allowed to be democratically elected. You know, it's the same
yeah.
with Allende in Chile. You know, we can't have a freely elected communist in the Western Hemisphere because the United States won't allow it. That kind of thing. I mean,
yeah, and they would take back their countries from the international corporate elite.
Yeah,
I mean
exactly.
That's part of the problem is. Yeah.
Well, they used to say what's good for United Fruit is good for Central America, you know? I mean, that's basically the way things are run. I mean, it's the power of these multinational corporations to exercise control through the use of American military power. And I mean, it's not just the Americans, but they're the most powerful, military force in the world. You know, you can dress it up and you can call it freedom and democracy, but at the end of the day, what it is, it's economic imperialism, and it's, you
yeah.
know, it's driven by the buck. You know, there's a line in the movie All the President's Men when Deep Throat is meeting Bob Woodward in the parking garage to feed him information about what's going on, and he says, follow the money. And really, if you follow the money in almost any story, you will never be wrong, you know, because people are motivated by money, you know. Ultimately, that's what drives things. It's like that where there's a lot of money involved, you know, if you really want the official explanation, don't pay attention to all the surface noise. Look at who's getting rich out of this, you know. Who's getting
yeah.
rich out of Iraq? Who's getting rich out of Afghanistan, you know?
Yeah.
The military-industrial complex in the United States is the people who are making money. They're making hideous amounts of money, and the American taxpayers are paying for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's bringing about the destruction of America, bringing about poverty
yeah.
on the Americans people, and now these monstrous, over $10 trillion now have been transferred to the banking institutions. I mean, it's the biggest bank fraud in human history, and it's impoverishing Americans and their children and grandchildren for decades.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's astonishing, you know.
Yeah.
And yet, 1 out of 12 homes, 12% of the homes, is people are default on the mortgages, and there are tent cities springing up, and people are losing their jobs, and it's incredible. I can't. These people who do these things, somehow there's something so... I mean, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. I worked with, like, the worst young offenders in Ontario, and then adult offenders in the provincial system, so they weren't the most serious adult offenders. But at least the guys I worked with as criminals, like, they had hard stories and hard lives, and I could always understand their crimes and why, what led to it, and, you know, the drug alcohol problems and abuse in the families and things like that. But these people who do this, the real criminals, like the serious psychopaths, they're completely a breed apart. Like the guys I worked with in jail, they would never, like, say, chemtrail thousands of people, you know, to make money and spread illness or put poisons in the inoculate. They wouldn't do devious things like that. Like that, in a way, is beyond my comprehension. I can't imagine someone being so disturbed in their essence somehow that they would do things like that. At least these guys I worked with, they had some integrity. There was a certain honor among thieves in a way. You know, but these people who took over our nations, they're psychopaths of a different order of any people I met within the prison system. Like, the real psychopaths aren't in prisons. They own the prisons.
Well, was it Woody Guthrie used to say that there's a song where he sings something to the effect that some people rob you with a gun and a knife and some people rob you with a fountain pen, you know? And that was during the Depression when all the farmers were losing their lands because the banks were foreclosing on them, you know, in the Midwest particularly. But, I mean, you know, like, I mean, you bring up this bank, you know, this incredible fraud and you know, the loss of all this money. It wasn't that long ago, and I'm not sure exactly. I'm just trying to Google it, actually. But when the savings and loan scandal happened under, I think that was under Bush the first, the amount of money, crisis of the 80s and 90s, SNL crisis, the amount of money, I remember P.J. O'Rourke, who's a humorist and who writes very, very good pieces, but he's also political, wrote a piece in Rolling Stone about how much money had been lost and how much the taxpayers were going to be on the hook for this for the next, like, you know, 60, 75 years. Like, it was unbelievable. I'm just seeing here, the ultimate cost of the crisis is estimated to have totaled around $160 billion. About $124 billion was directly paid by the government, i.e. the taxpayers. So, I mean, in terms of the current situation, it's not really that bad, but that's a serious amount of cash. You know, Everett Dirksen used to say in the 60s, you know, $1 million here, $1 million there, pretty soon we're talking about serious money. Well, you know, that's the way the level of fraud and theft occurs on now is, like, you know, millions, hundreds of millions, you know, billions, you know, oh, pretty soon, you know, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, pretty soon we're talking serious money. It's like, you know.
Yeah, now the word is trillions. I mean, the millions are nothing.
A trillion here, a trillion there, pretty soon we're talking serious money. It's like, again, when we were talking off air to Don, it's like people accept this, you know, that people become, they become desensitized in a sense to these criminal activities, and people, you know, I mean, the ultimate irony is that Ronald Reagan and the whole conservative Republican movement did more to destroy the middle class than in the United States than anybody, and put more and more money in the hands of fewer and fewer people, and yet nobody's more popular amongst the middle class than Ronald Reagan as the president. You know, like, how's that possible? You know, like, I mean, you know, like, it makes no sense. But again, it's image control and media coverage and manipulation of the facts. I mean, you know, that this is indisputable that under Reagan and under the Bushes, you know, there was more and more money put in the hands of, and under Clinton, I mean, more and more money, but started basically under Reagan, more and more money went into the hands of fewer and fewer people. And basically, the you know, with deregulation, that's where the whole financial crisis started I mean, that's one argument, that the whole current financial crisis started with deregulation under Reagan in the 80s, and especially deregulation of the financial industry. And essentially, everything was set in motion then, and so it's led to more and more people having less and less money. It destroyed all those manufacturing jobs in the United States, disappeared, and were never replaced. They were replaced with myth jobs, you know, like minimum wage or you know, low-paying jobs with no benefits, no unions, no protection, and you know, people accepted it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think people now are in fear because the powers of the government and the kind of creeping surveillance state and monitoring of regular citizens and the loss of people's constitutional rights and so people are retracting in fear, and I think that is a major part of the problem. Okay, well, I do want to try to move along here a little bit because I did want to go through these summaries of cap policies. I'm going to read through them, and then we'll try maybe open up the lines and see if we have any input from anyone in the audience. And if you think you might call in, I'm going to give out the call-in number in probably about 20 minutes or half an hour once I've gone through some of this. So I'll go through these policies, Jim. I'm not sure we'll get through them all.
Yeah.
We'll get halfway, then open up the lines and keep working through them if we don't have any calls. And I'll stop after each one, and we can have some discussion of each of them. Okay, as an introduction, I wrote, Canada is currently facing a major crisis. Our country is now governed to the advantage of a Canadian and international corporate and financial elite, and the government no longer represents the true interests of the common individual. The causes of the 9/11 attack on New York have never been honestly investigated, and our government and the corporate media have deceived Canadians as to the causes of the war in Afghanistan, where our troops are dying in service of an illegitimate war. We as Canadians have formed entangling alliances with the U.S., a nation engaged in criminal wars and terrorism around the world, bringing about economic collapse due to the activities of the financial and Wall Street elites, and moving towards a police state and surveillance society. The Security and Prosperity Partnership offers Canadians neither security nor prosperity, but only further enslavement by the so-called New World Order system. The Canadian public is being intentionally poisoned through atmospheric chemtrail spraying from coast to coast, while inoculation programs are creating all kinds of medical illnesses, and our food and water supply are being degenerated and health freedoms restricted. The police and intelligence communities no longer serve and protect the public, but have become complicit in serving and protecting the self-selected elites who have taken control of our country. Personal liberties are being infringed upon, as are legal rights to fair trials and hearing, and a surveillance and police state society is being incrementally fashioned around us. Worst of all, the Canadian public has been intentionally deceived by the mainstream media as to the underlying causes of all the major public news events, and the most significant news items go unreported. Oh, Canada has been lost. Our government and political parties have betrayed us, and the tentacles of the New World Order system have penetrated into every aspect of Canadian life. The Conservative, Liberal, NDP, and Green parties are all parts of this beast and obscure the real issues facing Canadians. In fact, it is only CAP, the Canadian Action Party, which stands apart from the New World Order system and wills to return the rule of law, human rights and freedom, democracy and sovereignty, and prosperity within Canadian society. We plead with Canadians to wake up to what is being covertly done within your country and to help us in reclaiming our government and country from the corporate and financial elites. So that is just an introductory statement. And then I'll go through, I've broken it down into 11 areas of policies. And I came up with this listing through going through all the CAP policies and trying to summarize what CAP's positions are. Okay, the first is human justice and civil rights. CAP demands an immediate investigation of the 9/11 attacks on New York City, as well as of the RCMP, CSIS, which is a Canadian intelligence service, and the military intelligence, who have been complicit in deceiving the Canadian public as to the causes of terrorism within our society. CAP demands the restoration of the rule of law within Canada, the repeal of police state legislation which deprives citizens of fair and open trials, and the maintenance of an open internet which has been the sole source of truth, news, and information during these troubled times. CAP demands the restoration of civil and legal rights as originally intended under the Canadian Bill of Rights and the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So that's a first clause, and that's what attracted me to CAP, because CAP had this policy of demanding an investigation of 9/11 and also demanding the withdrawal of Canadian troops from our involvement in Afghanistan. It was one thing for us to be involved in Afghanistan when we thought, or the public believed, that the Afghanistanis had given refuge to Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorists. But when this has all been proven now to have been a fraud, then really it is an illegitimate war. So CAP is demanding the investigation of 9/11 and demanding investigation of the police and intelligence services, which really have betrayed the Canadian public. They've allowed the public to be deceived about 9/11 as the basis for taking us to war. So if Canadians really knew the truth of what the government has done, we would be outraged, as I feel outraged. How dare they do this to us as a country and send our soldiers over there to secure the oil and drugs and military bases for these power elites? How disgraceful. That's completely out of the tradition of how Canadians have always seen ourselves as a peacekeeping country, and we've always used our soldiers for what we believed were peacekeeping activities as part of UN activities. Okay, and did you want to comment, Jim, on just that first, human justice and civil rights?
Yeah, well, I just say the one thing about Afghanistan is that, you know, Afghanistan has been a haven for Al-Qaeda and for Osama bin Laden, but so has Pakistan, and Pakistan was an ally in the war on terror. There's no sense to it. Like, you know, even if you bought into it, it's a stupid war in terms of, like, you're going to go over there and end terrorism? No.
Yeah.
You know, if you read anything about the history of Afghanistan, if you knew anything about it, you'd realize you can't fight a war on terrorists by invading countries. It doesn't work. I mean, it's just completely ludicrous. So even if you bought into it, it's stupid. And, you know, I just want to point out that until the Taliban were in power for a while, and, you know, nobody was really terribly upset about their policies towards women or their blowing up of Buddhist statues. It was when they opposed they suddenly started to express doubts about supporting the Unocal's building of a pipeline to Central Asia to get natural gas and oil, that the Taliban had to go. That's the reason why the Taliban are persona non grata in the West. It's got nothing to do with the fact that they're, you know, people don't like their backwards policies. It's a complete joke. They could live in Afghanistan for the next 10,000 years if there was no oil or natural gas to be exploited in Central Asia. It's that simple. Follow
yeah.
the money.
And also is the role of the U.S., the CIA, and the shadow operations in funding and setting up the Al-Qaeda and these terrorist organizations in the first place.
Well, I mean,
and even the U.S. government paid the salaries of the Taliban government for the two
yeah.
years before 9/11.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, in in Fahrenheit 9/11, you see Bush, you know, I think it's Bush with the Taliban, you know, when they came to Washington, eh? I mean, they were there. And, you know, nobody really had a problem with him. Nobody really had a problem with Saddam Hussein when he was the enemy of Iran and when he wasn't threatening the world's oil supply. They were all buddy-buddy with him, you know. Like, I mean, nobody was calling him a brutal dictator in those days. In fact, they were over there helping him build a bigger army and building bigger bunkers and funding his palaces, you know. Like, I mean, follow the money.
You know, when I worked in prison, one of the pieces of wisdom I learned from offenders there is they used to say when you pointed your finger at anyone,
oh, yeah,
how if you do that, you point your finger at someone and you have three fingers pointing back towards yourself.
Yeah.
So it's like before you point your finger at someone else, you know, you have to look at yourself. And that's how I see it now is like,
yeah.
You know, we kind of pretend the U.S. is this kind of force in service of righteousness and democracy and peace, and they're fighting terrorism. But really, the whole time, they were the terrorists.
Yeah.
Like, they undermined democratic countries around the world for the corporate elites. They decide we think we'll replace this regime this week. We don't like them. They're not sympathetic to us. They won't allow us to control them. So, there's the axis of evil, you know. Poor little North Korea, you know, like, you know. Iran, you know, now they're going to mass murders in Pakistan now, and then they want to take on Iran. These people are willing to take us to the brink of a third world war, or into one, I believe.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, if you read the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, one of the reasons why the military was so horrified by Kennedy is that he stopped them from starting World War III.
Yeah.
They very much wanted to drop nuclear bomb on Cuba, and they wanted to start World War III with the Russians. I mean, you know, at the end of the Second World War, you know, Patton said, let's just keep going. You know, start World War III right now, attack the Russians. There was all sorts of people in the military who believed that was the correct course of action. You know, years ago, Rampart's magazine, a radical magazine in the States, I think it must have been in the early 70s, while the Vietnam War was still on, had the picture of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on the cover of their magazine one time, and the caption was, "Are these the world's five leading terrorists?"
Oh, really?
Hell
wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I don't think it is really them. They're just the puppets of the people behind them.
Yeah.
Yes and no.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, some of these guys are honorable people and some of them are creeps, you know, and they're psychopaths. I mean, Curtis LeMay, who was head of the Strategic Air Command during the Cuban Missile Crisis, was a psychotic. And the guy under him was a known sadist and psychotic. He's the guy that General Jack D. Ripper was based. Well, LeMay is sort of, and this guy, his name was General Power. They were the basis for Jack D. Ripper in Dr. Strangelove, who goes nuts and attacks the Soviet Union on his own, eh? That's where they got that portrait. But, I mean, there are a lot of strange friggin' people who, there are honorable people at high levels of the military, too. I'm not tarring the military with one brush. I mean, I think, in fact, some of the saner voices since 9/11 have come from the military, but there are also people there who are bad human beings, you know.
Yeah, it's like they don't see any moral issue with America,
yeah,
like policing the world and bringing about the one world order under their kind of military dominance. Like,
yeah,
they don't understand. People have, I believe, an innate desire for freedom and self-expression, and yeah. Okay, so I'll move on to second area is monetary control. A re-empowered Bank of Canada is critical for the survival of Canada as an independent and sovereign nation. Today, 95% of the national debt is compound interest owed to private banks and investors, and Canadians pay approximately $37 billion a year in debt servicing. CAP will use the Bank of Canada instead of borrowing monies from the charter banks to fund infrastructure, social programs, and education. Historically, the Bank of Canada helped bring us out of the Depression, funded World War II, financed highways such as the McDonald-Cartier Freeway, public transportation systems, airports, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and our universal health care system and Canadian pension plan. CAP would increasingly, incrementally repatriate our debt back to the Bank of Canada, eventually eliminating the need of paying interest to private banks. This means lower income taxes for all and the funding of new infrastructure, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, and social programs. CAP would further reinstitute the use of statutory reserves, and we reject any suggestion of a common currency with any other country. Now, in this area, Canada's situation is somewhat different from the U.S., where the Federal Reserve, established in 1913, gave the bankers the exclusive right to print the money. Whereas in Canada, we've always had our own Bank of Canada, which could print our own money instead of borrowing it from the banks. But what happened is, as I see it, the Canadian government became to be controlled by the corporate and banking elites, and so they no longer used the Bank of Canada, but instead gave this as favors to the bankers, thus allowing a situation similar to what you have in the U.S., even though in Canada there's no need for that. We have our own Bank of Canada. We could print our own money, and it doesn't necessarily have to lead to inflation if that's invested into infrastructure and into the development of your civilian population and so on. So printing your own money isn't necessarily inflationary, but instead what Canada, the Canadian government has done is allowed the banks to take over effective control of our monetary money system, just as similar to what you have in the U.S. with the Federal Reserve. And I think more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that your government, I think it even violates the Constitution that they allowed this right to print your own money was given over to an independent private group of bankers. I think that is actually in violation of the Constitution of the states. So at least in Canada, we don't have that as serious a problem, I would say, as they have in the U.S. And in the U.S. now, people are waking up to what's being done, and that's a growing movement. Is first, Ron Paul has a bill up before the government, and he has, I gather, over 180 sponsors now who are demanding an audit of the Federal Reserve, which is a first step towards trying to regain control of the Fed. But anyway, that has long been that was historically CAP's main policy as a political party, that we wanted to, again, re-empower the Bank of Canada. Jim, that you comment on anything?
I got no money, so I'm not sure I'm qualified to be. What's that figure for Canadians servicing the debt? I
$37 billion.
I think I'd pay about half of that every month. Yeah. So it's like, yeah. I don't know. I don't know enough about this to really comment intelligently on it. I'll leave it alone for now.
Yeah.
I know in the States that. That's really interesting what Ron Paul is doing. I think that's really long overdue, you know, because it is like it's a temple and it's sort of like a cult, you know, the Federal Reserve. It's very peculiar.
Yeah. Okay, the third area, sovereignty. CAP would reevaluate Canada's involvement in the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. Although these agreements are represented as free trade agreements, they are essentially a charter of rights for corporations. NAFTA allows the U.S. and Mexican investors to sue Canadians if any of our governments, federal, provincial, or municipal, passes or amends a law that affects their profits or future profits. Canada rejects also the North American Union, the agenda of the corporate financial military elite to unify the territories currently occupied by Canada, U.S., and Mexico into one entity with a new border around the perimeter of North America under their aegis and control. The majority of Canadians are uninformed of this by their politicians and media. CAP will dissolve the North American Competitiveness Council, Canadian membership announced by Stephen Harper in June of 2006, and end the annual meetings of the three leaders of Canada, U.S., and Mexico on the NAU and SPP impetuses, and end international expansion into all areas of Canadian affairs, including defense, international trade, finance, immigration, justice, etc. So we want to get back to establishing and maintaining our sovereignty and not allowing this. It's a funny thing because in ways I always agreed. In ways I even agree with the idea of there being a one world government, but not if that government is ruled by a group of psychopathic financial and corporate elites. That's the problem.
Oh, you're so demanding.
Yeah. It's like I always supported.
Yeah, one world government would be great sense if it was actually composed of honorable human beings, but yeah, not a bunch of psychotics and a bunch of criminals, which is basically what you have. I mean, one thing that, you know, from a Canadian perspective that's critical about NAFTA and about the free trade agreement is that essentially the free trade agreement, as you say, it's what was your phrase? That was really good. I like that. It's a bill of...
A charter of rights for corporations.
That's precisely what it is. It allows them to avoid regulations. It allows them environmental regulations, labor regulations, and essentially it's a handout to them. But the big thing in Canada is that the number one thing that free trade was the main reason why the United States desperately wanted to have a free trade agreement with Canada, and Canadian politicians over and over again said that this wasn't part of it, but it is. It's water. We got a lot of it, and the United States doesn't have enough of it, and eventually the United States will take our water.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. I mean, that's why I think there, you know, in Canada we had a whole election about free trade between the Conservatives and the Liberals in the late 80s, and when Canada signed the free trade agreement, it passed both houses of Congress unanimously, like in 15 minutes. I mean, because it's a steal. I mean, that's why it passed. I mean, there's no reason for the United States not to agree with it. And now, of course, the irony is that with all the economic hard times, all of a sudden the United States wants to raise tariffs on trade with foreign countries. Well, what happened to the glories of free trade? This is supposed to bring peace and love and justice to the entire world. That's the way it was represented, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good for everybody. No, it's not. You know,
yeah.
No, it's not. It's a handout to the corporations. It's a license for them to get away with more things than they can get away with under a more regulated economic social order. You know, it's that simple.
It's a good way of fighting the auto unions where workers make good wages, like because of their unionization, and they make 60, 70 bucks an hour with their benefits. And instead now they can call it free trade, and they use slave labor in China where people make 10 cents a day or something. It's been a way that they've been not able to undermine the manufacturing sector in our own society.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And we've been so complicit because anything we can get for cheaper, we want to buy it. So the dollar stores are doing great, and all the Canadian manufacturers go out of business.
Yeah, and as I say, that's why, you know, I mean, this started under, really hit its stride under Reagan, and I mean the big losers in this is the American middle class. It destroyed the American middle class, and they got nothing back for it. And then, you know, Ronald Reagan is hugely popular historically amongst the American middle class. Like, talking about voting against your interests, like, you know, what was that comment from Prescott Bush, You know, they should have been. They'd hang us if they knew what we were up to. Well,
oh yeah, where he Bush said to the reporter, yeah, if people really knew what we had done, they'd be chasing us down the street to hang us.
Yeah,
that's
the problem,
now people are waking up to what they've done, and a lot of people are beginning to feel that, like.
Yeah,
there's mounting anger and talk of a second revolution. Everyone's buying up weapons and so on in the States. And
funny, in Canada, we had that. These programs have been on all through several countries. I think it started in England. But the greatest Canadian, the person who was voted the greatest Canadian, was Tommy Douglas, who was the head of the NDP, a socialist party, and who was the father of Canadian Medicare, who brought socialized medicine to Canada. And the person who was voted the greatest American was Ronald Reagan. And, you know, you couldn't get two starker contrasts in terms of, I mean, in Canada, there was a lobby amongst the unions to get Tommy Douglas apparently voted this, but I mean, you know, Tommy Douglas is actually a very good choice. I mean, he was a great Canadian, and he actually did something very meaningful for the Canadian people, you know, in bringing Medicare, even though he wasn't even in power and he got Medicare instituted, was brought in under the Liberals. But in the States, Reagan is the greatest American. That just slays me, you know. Like John Dillinger would have been a better choice in my mind. But you know, I digress. Like I just can't believe that. But Ronald Reagan, you serious? You know, like please.
Okay, so I'll move on to another area. I'm going to just go through two more areas, then we'll open up, and I'll keep going through the areas. But we'll take any calls if anyone wants to call in. Health and welfare. CAP demands the immediate cessation of chemtrail spraying. And this is so important. Where I live, I'm sprayed heavily here 4 to 5 days a week. There'll be planes that'll crisscross all across the sky. And these chemtrails come down. They form particular kinds of wispy clouds, big long clouds, and we're being sprayed, and the research is showing all kinds of toxic substances in these chemtrail sprays. And it's also aluminum and barium are the two primary elements. And you just think that one out of two families in the United States now has someone who suffers from Alzheimer's. And one of the causes of Alzheimer's, supposedly, according to some people, is a buildup of aluminum. Okay, so here we are, we're being sprayed, atmospheric spraying of aluminum flake over the populace. Okay, so as well as there's many other ingredients, and it's also a methodology that can be used by them at sometimes. Maybe they'll have some viral matter they want to spread through chemtrail spraying. In a way, this is non-lethal warfare being carried out upon people. It is lethal in the longer run. It doesn't kill people outright, but it spreads diseases. And not only is it poisoning ourselves, and there's new polymer fibers in these chemtrails, but it's also poisoning our pets, our land, our water. The water pH is out now more and more. We've got disappearing of the bee population. Perhaps the chemtrails are tied into that. We really don't know. And the fact that this chemtrail spraying is being done coast to coast across Canada and the United States, I mean, it's quite outrageous. Okay, so CAP demands the immediate cessation of chemtrail spraying and of any enforced inoculations. And the new head of the Canadian Action Party is a PhD psychologist and medical doctor whose expertise is in inoculations and all the ill effects being caused by them. All of them, he says. And we have, especially in the States, there are now 1 million autistic children in the United States. Now, when I began studying psychology 30 years ago, Alzheimer's would receive about a chapter in a 400-page book because it was so rare and might occur like perhaps in 1 in 10,000 or 20,000 cases. Like it was almost unheard of. Whereas now, imagine that, 1 million families with autistic children. And then the drug manufacturers, they deny and they deny their inoculations of anything to do with it. Andrew Molden, our new CAP leader, is one of the world's experts on inoculations who's involved in the States at the moment as a witness in groups which are trying to bring massive civil suits against some of the pharmaceutical companies. So CAP is against any enforced inoculations. And now their inoculations are being—they're enforced among children as they grow. There's certain required inoculations. The military has to take all kinds of inoculations, and they've historically been used as guinea pigs by the pharmaceutical companies. Like some people claim that the 400,000 disabled vets from the Gulf Wars, the disabling was mainly through the inoculations and through the use of the depleted uranium. So in Canada now there's even colleges and universities. You have to have inoculations in order to attend the universities. Now all these inoculations, they're brought in without adequate testing, without adequate follow-up, and they government doesn't properly follow up on monitoring the health of the people they give the inoculations to. It's quite outrageous. CAP also opposes the Codex Alimentarius, in which Big Pharma seeks to control the vitamin and supplement industries and to restrict citizens' access to health food products and services and organic foods. We want investigations into the fluoridation of the water, the widespread use and approval of pharmaceuticals, the dangers of the additive aspartame, and the covert introduction of GM foods into the Canadian food supplies. CAP would foster a genuine Canadian drug industry instead of the giant for-profit U.S. drug industry and require the labeling of all genetically modified and irradiated foods. So that was on health and welfare. Jim, any comments on anything there? Do you notice the chemtrails much? I guess I live in the country a lot. Yeah,
I'm in the city. I mean, I barely look at the sky. You know, like, I mean, all I can see is smog here. So it's like, you know, it's pretty dirty. Although somebody actually was talking about this a little while back and saying that they've been spraying over Toronto. So I don't really know. I mean, I don't really know.
Yeah. No, where I live, I'm in the countryside and I have a panoramic view of the sky over Ottawa. And so I've over the last years, actually now, you know, constantly watch every day. I even keep records sometimes in my calendars what days they spray and kind of study and observe it as a phenomenon. And it's amazing. I go out and I'm in the towns and such, and I point out the chemtrails to people and they say, look, you're being sprayed. There's poisons, you know. I try to explain it to people. It's like people, it's beyond them. They can't, well, why would anyone poison us? You know, they can't imagine anything. Like,
I have that question. I mean, I can see people getting rid of things that they don't want, but I don't buy that people are intentionally poisoning people. I mean, I don't believe that.
Yeah, are you not familiar with the UN and Kissinger and these people who want to kind of bring the world's population down to 500 million? And
but, you know, my question is, these people live under those places where we're talking about people being sprayed. They live there too.
Well, that's very interesting. I agree with that. And
I mean, their wives and families and their children are, you know, I mean, you know, they're exposed to it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, I mean, in terms of controlling the world's population, there are all sorts of ways of doing it. But one way is just kill them all. Like, I mean, kill lots of people through lots of wars, and you can make lots of money. I mean, there's that. You know, there's always that way. That's
well, I mean, I think they use different ways. I mean,
that's very
wars.
I don't get this. See, I can see them spraying things because they're toxic. People dump toxic waste all the time.
Yeah.
You know, all
well,
the
think,
time. I mean, that's happened all over the United States and Canada for the last 50 years, you know. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, I live within 75 miles of the Love Canal. But it's a very different thing to say that people are intentionally poisoning the population to kill them or to give them diseases. I mean,
yeah,
I don't.
That's
I don't,
how I see it.
I don't see that. I mean, and even with inoculations, I mean, I think what's really interesting with Andrew Moulton's work is that he's talking about the effects of injections. Eh? Like he,
yeah.
I mean, he is talking about the substances being injected. But he's talking about injection sites themselves, eh? Which I mean, I had read about this in animals. I don't inoculate my cats every year. In fact, I inoculate only the one that's outside every few years because I had read about this, about cancer developing at injection sites. Eh? His work, I think his work is very, very interesting, what he's saying. I don't know it very well, but when you had him on that day and I read a little bit about what he had been saying, I think that's very, very, very interesting. And as for the attempt from the pharmaceutical industry to restrict Canadians' access to health food products and vitamins is just outrageous.
Isn't that outrageous?
Oh, that is so ridiculous. It's like, you know,
I know.
I've signed petitions and everything, but I mean, even to have the balls to even bring that up, you know, it's like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, like,
yeah. Yeah, it's so outrageous.
It is.
So
it's completely. I mean, there's where you like, you know, that's where the conspiracy theorist in me kicks in. It's like, what genius sat around figuring this out, eh? Oh, I got an idea. Why don't we try to pass a bill? You know, like.
And you know, part of this new Codex Alimentarius, and
well,
in Canada it's called BC51, and now they're trying to it was kind of beaten back a little bit. Now they're introducing it as C5, Bill C5 and Bill C6 and so on. But part of what it is, it also gives them all kinds of police state rights. It gives the police, here's some of what Bill C51, it allows the police to enter private property without a warrant, take your property at their discretion, dispose of your property at will, not reimburse you for your losses, seize your bank accounts without a warrant, charge owners shipping and storage charges for seized properties, store your property indefinitely, levy fines of up to $5 million and or seek 2 years in jail per charge.
This is
the charge for having like vitamins and minerals, or what they're going to call, they have a new word for it, therapeutic products.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to ban, therapeutic products, and make it so you have to get a doctor's prescription. And there's so few doctors, no one can ever see a private doctor. Anyway, so you got, and then, you know, it'll be a good racket for the doctors, so I'm sure that the Canadian Medical Association will support it.
Of course, I mean, the other side is that you know, the health food industry is a billion-dollar industry in Canada. It's a very, very, very lucrative business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that, you know, their lobbyists are busy, you know, fighting this back. I mean, I know that, you know, there's quite widespread outrage. But, I mean, as I say, just the idea that they would introduce this. You know, I don't know if I just remember this the other day. I was telling somebody this. You know that Flaherty, who's the Canadian finance minister, right?
Uh-huh.
When he ran for he was in the Conservative government under Mike Harris in the province of Ontario, and he ran for the Conservative leadership in Ontario. He had a couple of interesting platforms. He wanted to put homeless people in jail, and he wanted to pass some bill that if the police found that you had money with cocaine residue on it, that you could be arrested for possessing the profits of an illegal proceed, or, you know, of criminal proceed.
Wow, really?
Yeah, no, except that somebody had the good sense to point out to him that 98% of the money in circulation has cocaine residue on it.
Wow, really, eh?
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
So the chances are is that, you know, he probably was carrying, the chances are almost 100% that he was carrying money in his wallet, which had cocaine residue on it. But this is a genius that's in charge of the Canadian. He wanted to put homeless people in jail, too. Even the other conservative candidates thought he was crazy. But he's now the national finance minister in Canada.
Wow.
Yeah,
pretty serious.
That
health restrictions on health care. And in the States, they're even trying to stop, like, organic gardening and farmers by forcing them to register everything and pay levy fines for all kinds of atrocious fines for having organic products and I mean, people in the States now, I think, are turning to what they used to call victory gardens. Like, people are realizing, hey, we better get our gardens going here.
Yeah,
we got some serious psychopaths who are trying to poison us.
Grow your own food, yeah.
Yeah, grow your own food. And now for them to crack down on this. And also, you know, I was thinking, I'm working at writing cap policies lately, and I'm drawing up a new one. I'm trying to propose some new policies to the party, and one of them has to do with testing of pharmaceutical drugs before they're released, and I was thinking, imagine if you had testing where you didn't just compare the use of the pharmaceutical drug to a placebo or some other pharmaceutical drug, but you actually compared the value of the pharmaceutical drug relative to a regime established by a holistic nutritionist, naturopath, so if you were going to compare government inoculations for flu, and you compared that to people taking a regimen of, garlic, herbs, what's this new oil that people are taking that's supposed to be very good? I forget what it's, turmeric? Or no, it's not turmeric. It's something like that. I have some myself. And silver water. Like, what if you compared the pharmaceutical drugs to a regimen of holistic health supplements and compared that? That would be a neat test. Because the pharmaceutical drugs should not only introduced into the market, they should be able to establish their superiority to less intrusive methods based on natural nutrients.
Part of the problem, though, too, is you know, I mean, it's educating people about taking care of their own health and being responsible for their own health to a certain extent, and not just relying on pharmaceuticals for everything. You know that the evidence for children's inner ear infections, the evidence that taking medication versus just allowing the inner ear infection to run its course is overwhelming. That the proper course of treatment is just leave it.
Yeah.
Don't do anything.
Yeah.
But parents consistently demand, well, you know, the kid's in distress and the kid's not feeling well, so give us a prescription. And doctors do it. And they do it all the time, you know, even though doctors know that, you know, that that's not really the right thing to do. But parents demand it, too. I mean, part of it is that people are so skewed in thinking that, oh, you know, I have to have a prescription for this. I have to have a prescription for that. You know, I have to have a pill to do this. But that's part of the education we have, too, is that people have to realize that there are alternatives, you know, that there are meaningful. Lots of people do know that there are meaningful alternatives to pharmaceuticals. And, I mean, let's face it, there's lots of situations where you want pharmaceuticals. But having said that, there are a lot of people who just, you know, blindly, you know, oh, I'll take an antibiotic. I hear people all the time when they have a cold, they take an antibiotic, or they want to go to a doctor and get an antibiotic. You've got a cold. An antibiotic isn't going to cure it, first of all. Secondly, you know, you got a cold. Live with it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, take something for relief if you're, you know, you're miserable, you got to go to work. I mean, I've done that. But, I mean, it's partly up to consumers too. It's partly up to people to educate themselves, you know. I mean, take care of your body too. Like, I mean, eat properly, exercise, you know, all the things that, you know, you want to avoid high cholesterol and having to take Crestor and Lipitor for like 35, 40 years of your life. Eat properly, you know, exercise,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, some people obviously have a congenital problem. It doesn't matter. But I mean, for the bulk of people, there's been a huge shift in Canadian population in the last 20 years because of the Canadian Heart Association, or I forget the organization, but they've educated the Canadian public. We had a really terrible record in Canada in terms of cardiovascular disease because people didn't exercise and didn't eat properly, and there's been a vast improvement in Canadian heart health because of this initiative to educate people, you know, and not just give them drugs, but educate them as to what they can do for themselves.
I'm going to give out our phone number here, and then we'll just continue on. If anyone does want to call in, the number is 888-815-9756. I mean, one problem here too is the use of the media to sell, their control of the media through the corporate and big pharma interests. Like, I mean, you know, they're selling. Harper put out $300 million of Canadian taxpayer money to give Gardasil inoculations to all grade 8 girls in the maritime provinces, or some sectors of it.
Yeah.
And firstly, Gardasil has been causing all kinds of adverse reactions in the States, including deaths. And it's quite unnecessary in terms of it's trying to treat a disease which generally is resolvable through other means. And then you see on the TV that you see a whole media campaign to sell men on taking Gardasil vaccinations. And they actually had doctors on TV who were reporting that they were prescribing it for men to take it. And the whole thing, like, where's the data for this? Where's the scientific evaluation of the value of men taking Gardasil vaccinations? You know, and I'm sure the whole thing is a crock. There isn't any.
Yeah.
You know, and yet it's sold because someone's making money off it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of these free trade agreements is it allows these corporations, when they engage in criminal and negligent practices, it allows them to avoid being civil suits. That's a major problem. I'm not sure all the details of that, but often it puts the corporations beyond the reach of the law for class action suits against them. Okay, so going on, local sustainable development. The Canadian Action Party supports the farming and gardening communities to provide energies for automotives, food, building materials, fabrics, and detergents for local communities. The Canadian farming industry is in crisis. Instead of small is beautiful, small is now to be driven out of business, the product of globalization and the so-called free trade agreements that have opened our country to predatory practices. A few large transnational corporations monopolize the world's food supply, from seed to feed to processing, in order to make producers and consumers totally dependent. We must be free of corporate agribusiness controlled by international corporations. CAP supports a moratorium on the foreclosure of mortgages on farm properties, a review of farm mortgages to rewrite debts so that farmers can operate profitably, and the restoration of grain subsidies. CAP would create a wealth of local agricultural and manufacturing jobs and business opportunities through support of the farms and the organic gardens and the introduction of innovative manufacturing technologies. We as an independent nation are capable of providing for our own basic food, energy, and diverse products, and doing so would revitalize rural communities and the manufacturing sector. Yeah, it's a disgrace when you look back and, in a way, how many farmers were forced off their land. Families which had owned farms for years and years, and because of the kind of predatory banking and mortgage schemes, farmers were forced off their land, and more of the land were taken over by multinational corporations. And that's a real shame, and that's happened across Canada. And it's the new legislation that are making it increasingly difficult for organic farmers and gardeners. And this item also touches upon another CAP proposal, which is concerns the idea of using alcohol as a fuel for vehicles. And apparently in the early 1900s, a lot of the cars ran on alcohol.
Yeah.
And Henry Ford, actually, his cars ran on alcohol at one point. But then it was only because of the kind of racketeering of the oil cartel that the whole use of alcohol as a fuel was lost and replaced by using only a petroleum. And there's been a fellow who, I forget his name, Bloom, I think, he has a website, Alcohol is a Gas, I think is the title of his website. And he explains that you could have local communities across the country producing the products you need to produce your own alcohol, and which you could, it costs under $1,000 to switch a car over from petroleum to pure alcohol or a petroleum alcohol mix. So the CAP idea is that we want to support the local farming community across Canada and develop alcohol as a fuel and get away from petroleum-based gases. And this would be a huge boost to the farming community. And also, when alcohol burns as a gas, it only gives off water. So it also helps in terms of greenhouse gases.
I wonder how efficient that is in terms of, like, not, I mean, in terms of the energy. Like, it's like the ethanol thing, you know, like the ethanol sounds like a good idea, but the actual economics of it really doesn't work in terms of, because you put so much energy into growing the corn to, you know, to provide the ethanol, that it's really, you know, it's become a scam, basically. But I wonder, like, about the economics of that and energy, like, conservation. Like, it'd be interesting to, I mean, I knew that about alcohol. I mean, during the war, I know people ran vehicles on alcohol. Like, you know, there's no reason why you can't do it. But, you know, I'd be interested to read more about that, to learn more about that.
It's interesting because I think there have been all kinds of innovations which have been repressed or suppressed. Like, I was hearing on the show the other day, there was just several attempts, people who have designed carburetors. And they've actually had cars which could get 100 miles a gallon by vaporizing the gas through the carburation somehow. I'm not really sure what's involved. And there have been a lot of innovations in, you know, electrical cars. I mean, they developed those. They were very successful, but they scrapped them, not because of people wanted them. And there was an outcry among the people who had the electric cars. They wanted to keep them. But it's been the oil monopolies which have kind of suppressed all these alternate methodologies. And this fellow Stan Myers in the States, who somehow used water and designed a car, he said could travel from one coast to the other of the United States on 22 gallons of water. And somehow he separated the water into the hydrogen and oxygen, and then you burn the hydrogen, and that empowers the car. And he had a working prototype of this, and he approached the U.S. military, and they wanted to buy it out, but he refused to do that, and then he died mysteriously of poisoning, and his invention disappeared from the market. Now imagine if that were possible. that you could power cars through water. And then if that were possible, you could power cars through water, then it's likely you could use the same process to heat your home and to provide electricity within your home. Because if you can produce energy through one form, the technology is available to transform it. Like if you can produce combustion of alcohol, you can use that to turn the generator to generate electricity. So, I mean, it's possible a person might have a unit in your home where you have to put in 5 gallons of water a week and it produces your hydro and you're self-sufficient. I think there have been a lot of innovations which have been suppressed because of the monopoly, not only of the oil cartels, but also of the power and the hydro and the nuclear plants. So I think we need a whole investigation of all these energy alternatives which have been repressed. And we need a government to do that and not simply, play second fiddle to the corporate interests. Instead, we need a government that actually introduces green technologies for Canadians. Europe's far ahead of North America now, especially in the use of photoelectric cells. We hardly see that at all in Canada, but that technology has been around for a fair time now, even though initially very expensive. So that's another area. Energy freedom. CAP would free Canadians from their dependency on damaging fossil fuels. This would include the funding of existing alternative technologies and the use of electricity, alcohol, and or water as fuel for automobiles. So CAP would invest likely billions of dollars even into this whole alternate energy methodologies and begin introducing these into Canadian society. And it's interesting, as you say, Jim, like we wouldn't want to put so much farmland use over to alcohol that you then make food go up. I mean, you don't want to do that. And I think that was part of the scare a little bit with the ethanol, is that they were using more farmland to produce gas, but while the people were hungry. And it can't work like that.
There's a guy, just on back to farming, you know, there's a guy in the States, he's a poet and a writer, his name is Wendell Berry. He's a farmer in Kentucky, and he's about the most beautiful writer I think I've ever read in my life. He has a great book, which was written in the 80s, when Reagan was president, called The Unsettling of America, about farming, which is really, really good. And, I mean, you can go on, I'm just on his website. He has over 40 books. As I say, he's a poet, but he writes beautifully, but he writes very intelligently about farming too, and he is a farmer. So you can get a lot of interesting ideas by reading Wendell Berry. He's been at this for a long time and has a lot to say, but that particular book, The Unsettling of America, is really, really interesting.
And for listeners, I would also recommend, if you're interested in alternative energies, a website which is www.byronwine.com, spelled BYRONWINE, byronwine.com. And I heard this gentleman on the one of the Truth Networks the other day, and he was telling of all the different inventions that have come out at different points, but which have been suppressed. Like, he gives the examples of carburetors where vehicles were getting 100 miles a gallon, he talks about the Myers work with the water as a fuel and cold fusion and all these different technologies. So that's an excellent website for anyone interested. Okay, so why don't I carry on a little bit? Oh, environmental issues. The Canadian Action Party demands open public debate on the truth or fraud of the global warming debate and rejects the imposition of global carbon taxes on Canadian citizens as a means of funding international organizations or Canadian government. CAP is committed to preserving our forests, waters, air, and environment, and to reduce pollutants and toxins, including greenhouse gases. So, when I went through our old policies, we had earlier endorsed outright the global warming scare, and we had accepted that without reservation, that we said that global warming was undeniable. Whereas now the evidence, I think, there's now been over 30,000 scientists who've signed a petition questioning the whole global warming claim.
Who do they work for?
Sorry?
Who do they work for?
I'm not really sure.
I don't see how anybody can say that there isn't evidence for global warming. I think you can question what is causing it, but I think the evidence is pretty strong there's global warming.
There are some other evidences. Some people even say they think there's evidence for global cooling. I mean, there, as you say, Jim, there are different links here. First is there global warming occurring? And then secondly, is that due to man-made burning of fossil fuels, or is that due to natural cycles? Some people claim the whole solar system is warming up. So I guess the main point here with CAP, we haven't taken a definite position that we believe or disbelieve in, but that we think it's important to maintain open public debate. That's the main issue, because the global warming has been sold through the corporate media as a given beyond.
No, wait a minute. I strongly disagree with that. I would say that the biggest fight against the idea of global warming, and even to look at it as a serious issue, was sponsored by the corporate elite. And I mean, you're basically saying exactly what Stephen Harper said. I mean, he questioned all sorts of things in opposing Kyoto, saying that there was no evidence for global warming. I mean, you know, he's a conservative politician who represents the corporate elites. I mean, I don't see that as being a product of the Canadian, of the, you know, the corporate media. I mean, I think the science is pretty strong on this, and that really the strongest opposition has come from the corporate elite to even acknowledging that there might be a problem. I mean, you could say that this is a possibility. I suppose it is a possibility, but I mean, that's really oversimplifying things, and it's just not accurate. As I say, like the strongest opposition to treating the problem of global warming, to even acknowledge that there might be a problem, has come from the corporate elite. They've consistently denied it. They've consistently opposed it. The American government wouldn't sign Kyoto, and has been the biggest opposition to acknowledging that there's a global problem. So, I mean, who's that driven by? That's why who are those 30,000 scientists? I know that in one of the earlier petitions, most of them were paid for. They all work for the petrochemical industry, you know.
I would have thought the opposite, that the people who have been paid for are the people who supported the global warming agenda. I mean, I think partly what happened is the elite switched horses one way. Initially, when they wanted to deny global warming and deny the destructiveness of greenhouse gases, but then halfway through they realize, oh well, we could use this to our advantage by imposing carbon taxes on people.
Yeah, but the biggest losers is the petrochemical industry. I mean, fossil fuels. You know, that's the biggest problem. They're the big losers. I mean, then, you know, as you say, I mean, they're about three notches below child molesters in terms of their ethics. So. I really strongly disagree with that. I mean, why did the Canadian Action Party endorse it originally?
Well, I think at that point when it originally came out, I think it took time for the dissenting scientific community to come forward more.
No, I think you should read a little bit more about the history of that, because I think that's completely wrong. I mean, I think that the dissenting scientific community has been there from the very beginning, and that it's... there's been very strong opposition to the idea of it all along, that first of all, that there was such a thing. Secondly, that when the evidence began to be overwhelming that there was. I mean, it seems pretty clear that the polar caps are melting, you know? I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, you know, I think that's a fact.
I think there is.
Oh, I think you're completely wrong about that. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But having said that, the first wave of opposition was, it's not happening, there's no problem. The second wave was, well, it's not due to anything that we're doing, and that in any way limiting carbon emissions isn't going to have any effect on it, that it's a natural process. I mean, there's been two waves of opposition to it. So I'm not sure that, I think you should look a little more closely into the history of the opposition science to this idea, because a lot of it came directly and was sponsored by industry.
Yeah, Jim?
Yep.
Sorry, I didn't catch you. Anyway, just to come back to this, I missed a little bit of what you were saying.
Okay.
The main thing is that TAP's position is that we want this openly debated and investigated more clearly, because there is issue now, and it is hard to know what is the true science and what is the agenda.
I would say that the way we're going, this is the equivalent of Rome fiddling, or Nero fiddling while Rome is burning. You know, the time is running out for major changes to be made in the way that we live. And, you know, all of this is really opposed to the use of alternate energies, too. Like,
yes,
that's a big
yeah.
part of it, is that people don't want to invest. But we should, I don't see that there's any argument that we should be moving away from fossil fuels and trying to get more independent, you know, alternate energies which are less polluting. So, I mean, you know,
yeah.
that.
Yeah, CAP totally endorses
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Like, whether or not you believe in global warming, I mean, it's pollution. I mean, you can see, you drive into Toronto, you can see the city 30 miles away, the smog over the city. And most big cities, Mexico City, you know, is a danger zone downtown, you know. So, okay, so continuing along, let's see what other item. Okay, we haven't had any. There may be someone who wanted to come in on the line here. I don't know. At one point I thought someone came in, but I'm not sure. We'll go back to the role of the military in international relations. Okay, Canadian Action Party is fully committed to a national defense program for Canada, commanded by Canadians in the service of Canadian interests, both domestic and international. Prime Minister Harper says that Canadian troops are fighting in Afghanistan because of the deaths of 24 Canadians from the fall of the World Trade Center on 9/11. However, since the true causes of 9/11 have been hidden from the public, CAP calls for the immediate withdrawal of our troops from Afghanistan and a parliamentary review of future roles and capabilities for the Canadian military. CAP would also end government contracts to military companies involved in missile defense, landmines, and weapons containing depleted uranium. I thought actually that it was against Canadian law for uranium to be sold to any other country for its use as weapons, but understand that now we openly violate this. And there's some in eastern Ontario where I live that they've started mining uranium and forced the native tribes off their lands, and the number of natives who protested were jailed in Ontario because of this, the corporations coming in and mining uranium. So now I live in the downwinds of the uranium mining in Ontario. CAP also wants to end the war mentality culture driven by greed and lust for power and the desire of the elites to control and dominate people all over the world. CAP seeks to promote policies supporting peace, justice, and freedom for all. CAP will ensure adequate military funding for the purposes of peacekeeping, protecting our sovereign coastal and Arctic borders, and disaster relief. I don't know, Jim, do you have any comments along that line?
Sounds good to me. You know, yeah.
Yeah. One thing CAP
doesn't
have...
that's so far from where we are. But I mean, yeah,
I know
that would be so nice if that was true. I mean, if our military was actually doing that, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because that's what the Canadian public, who have been dummied down, kind of have been led to believe, is that's what we were doing. Like, we all kind of say how much we want peace in the world. But then people just say one thing and do something completely different.
Yeah.
Like the Department of, it's called the Department of Defense, the American Department of Defense. But they're anything but defensive. I mean, they're offensive around the world.
They used to be the War Department, you know.
Oh, you was it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's more appropriate.
Yeah, well, there's much more honest name for it, you know. Like, yeah.
It's also very discouraging, like, seeing how Canada's involved in the United Nations and NATO, okay? And, like, now it appears that both the United States and NATO are completely corrupted. Like, they're not just, honorable military alliances, but the members of NATO, I think that's why so many NATO countries haven't wanted to send troops to Afghanistan, because they've known that it's been a criminal war from the beginning. Don't you think? Like, how the U.S. is always trying to bully people into sending more troops, and they try to make it sound as though it's like a world effort to fight terrorism.
Yeah.
But all the NATO countries really know it's all a fraud. I think that's why there's been such resistance.
I think a lot of them know it. You know, it's a losing battle, first of all, and that you can't afford it. I mean, I heard a guy a couple of weeks ago on the CBC radio, two military guys, military analysts, talking about Afghanistan, one American and one Canadian. The Canadian guy had been in Afghanistan. And, you know, the new guy who's taken over is the commander in Afghanistan. His thing is counterinsurgency. Essentially, what they're going to do in Afghanistan is institute another program like Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, which targeted civilians and is an assassination program. Operation Phoenix killed 50,000 people in Vietnam. They identified certain people that they thought were sympathetic to the Viet Cong or to the North Vietnamese, and they murdered them. I mean, it's assassination.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what they're going to do. This Canadian guy said that's what they're going to do in Afghanistan to get out, because the Americans realize they can't afford to fight this war. It's just they can't pay for it. They can't afford it. They have to eventually withdraw. And as I say, 10 years from now, I guarantee you, 10 years from now, people are going to look back and say, what the hell was that about? I mean,
yeah.
you know, the Soviets were there, the British were there, and nobody ever wins there. That's the first
yeah.
thing. If you open a friggin' history book, that's the first thing you'd realize. These guys are living like they did 1,000 years ago, but they've got Stinger missiles, and they've got improvised explosive devices, and they've been fighting the Russians, and they've been fighting the British, and they'll fight everybody who comes there. And in the end, they'll go back to living the way that they did before. And people will say, well, what was that? Well, we made the country safe for the opium trade. You know, like, I mean, that's what it's going to boil down to. I guarantee it. It's like, it's
yeah,
not,
no, I see it as very different. I mean, I don't think America ever plans on leaving Iraq or Afghanistan.
No, I think I wouldn't be surprised if they were out of both of them. That doesn't mean they're going to
yeah,
go back.
Yeah,
they won't go back in, but, you know. That's why I say, like, I was very, very disappointed that Obama said, well, we're going to get out of Iraq, but we're going to step it up in Afghanistan. And again, I mean, here's the logic. Here's something. Think of what happened with the first Intifada in Israel. It was contained in a piece of land, basically. It was an uprising with kids with rocks and bricks throwing them at the Israeli defense forces. And it occurred in a piece of land which is about the size of a postage stamp. I mean, a little tiny piece of land. And the Israeli Defense Forces, who aren't sort of shy about, kicking asses when they have to, tried to suppress this thing. The Israeli government tried to suppress it. It went on and it went on and it went on. And then it stopped, and then it started again a few years later. Okay. If a bunch of guys with bricks and stones can do that in a circumscribed territory where they're overwhelmingly outmatched by a sophisticated, maybe the best military in the world, what chance does any army have of going into a country the size of Afghanistan or Iraq and suppressing terrorism? I mean, even if you believe in it, even if you buy it hook, line, and sinker, it doesn't make any sense. It's stupid. It's just incredibly stupid. There's no logic to it.
Yeah. and then your forces themselves become the terrorists. The Americans now are, I see them as a terrorist nation.
Well, the old line was, the famous line from Vietnam was that in order to save the village, we had to destroy it. Well, that's essentially what's going to happen in Afghanistan too. You know, because they couldn't tell who were the bad guys and who were the good guys, quote unquote, in Vietnam, they just burned villages down. You know, and then the strategic hamlet relocation program, they took people out of their villages and relocated them in safe compound. Of course, in doing that, they alienated the Vietnamese people because they took them off their land, which they had a very special relationship to and which is very much a part of their culture, and completely alienated them and made them, basically drove them into the arms of the North Vietnamese. You know, you can't go around imposing your will militarily on people and think that you're going to change them so that they'll live the way that you want them to live. I mean, it doesn't work that way. I mean, and as I say, even if you buy the whole rationale for it, which clearly you and I don't, but even if you do, it just doesn't make any sense. It's so dumb, you know. I mean, some of these clowns should crack a history book open once in a while and read about these places and find out, you know, something about their history before they go running off and, you know, committing these ridiculous crimes. And as you say, you end up committing more atrocities and becoming terrorists yourself. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, now the war in the Middle East is expanding, like the U.S. has become involved in Pakistan, and they start these offensive against the supposed al-Qaeda up in the highlands. And, you know, 1.5 million people are refugees overnight.
Yeah.
And you have another humanitarian kind of disaster.
Well, who's done more for recruiting for al-Qaeda than George Bush and Dick Cheney? Nobody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the irony. I mean, it was like a manna from heaven for these guys is to have these clowns running around, you know, committing all sorts of crimes against, if you're a Muslim living in the Middle East and people are telling you that the Americans were the great Satan, I mean, it's not like that they haven't given them reason to think that, you know.
And it's so sad, too, because I've always so much in ways admired America. I guess America to Canada, I've always, is like a big brother kind of. To me, it always was a bit. You know, I always looked up to America like I believed it. I believed they were democratic. I believed that they, you know, fought for truth. And it's kind of a nightmare to kind of wake up and to realize all this has been lies, and I feel so sorry for all the American servicemen who are completely deceived into these wars and kind of think they're defending their nation, while the whole time it has nothing to do with the defense of their nation.
Yeah.
You know, they've been hijacked. The American military has been hijacked by these international banksters and corporate elite. You know, it has nothing to do with spreading democracy. And then you realize America isn't a democracy. I mean, you can't have a democracy when you have two political parties completely controlled by the same criminal corporate elite. And the whole thing is a farce. And you got electronic voting machines and it's the whole thing. It's like a democracy, you have to have an informed public. And you have to deal with this issue of the financing of these political parties, because somehow, you know, it's like the more psychopathic someone is, the further they're going to advance politically.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the other thing I was going to say is the issue of like Canada's role in NATO and the UN. I always kind of believed in the UN, but again, I'd bought into the fraud of the whole thing. And now you realize, like, the people in the UN must know 9/11 was an inside job. How could they not know? I mean, they might have not known for years, but I can't see these people any longer still maintaining that fraud that they you know, and yet no one mentions it in the UN. Like, you know, doesn't anyone there? I don't understand even why Russia doesn't bring it to the UN or I mean, I guess Chavez did, I think, in the UN. Did you ever see the speech where he came up to the podium after George Bush?
It smelled sulfur.
And he smelled sulfur, yeah. I mean, he kind of sniffed it. I smell sulfur. The devil, Satan has been here. That was so funny.
That's kind of hilarious myself, actually. I mean, Hugo's an interesting guy. Like, I mean, I don't think he's all there in some ways, but I think he's... I kind of admire him on some level. I mean, I think in some ways he's quite a psychopath himself, but in other ways I think he's, you know, he's quite admirable, and that was something I definitely approved of. But yeah,
it's a shame because some leaders in countries who might want to maintain their independence, they're kind of forced into alliances. I think, like you see Venezuela now, you know, they forced into a stronger alliance with Russia and China, you know. So now, you know, it even endangers us more in America by, you know, the way the U.S. government and their shadow elements have tried to assassinate Chavez several times and undermine his reign in Venezuela. And then this brings even more threat to ourselves. You know, if we just let these countries be, it's just astonishing to me. There's just so much rampant criminality on an international level and just some massive lies. You know, I believe we need an international body, but now, you know, it's very hard to understand. The UN has become so corrupted as well.
We're running out of time, by the way.
Yeah, we only have... we have maybe 5 minutes left, so maybe. Well, I've managed to get through most of the cap policies here, and we're still, you know, we're very small as a political party, and I see cap as being what I call the only non-New World psychiatric disordered party in Canada. Because all I see the other four parties or five parties, including the Bloc Quebecois, none of them are willing to address the truth of 9/11. And what that implicates or implies is ultimately their control within the same system. And these problems are systemic. It's not like Stephen Harper's just such a bad guy. It's not just Stephen Harper. It's a systemic problem. The liberals are complicit, the conservatives, the NDP, the Greens. No one speaks the truth of these things. And so much is hidden from the public in Canada, as it is in the States and around the world. So that's why I've become involved in the Canadian Action Party. And if there are Canadians out there, we are looking for support and trying to grow as a party to provide an alternative political view within Canada. And in the States, you have Ron Paul, who seems to be one of the most ardent and eloquent supporters of a new order. Did you hear Ron Paul, Jim, when he first came out? He was saying about how America has military bases in like 140 countries of the world and how he would bring all the American soldiers home. That's what he said. You know, he'd get back to when America was supposed to maintain a non-interventionist policy. Like that was a traditional conservative platform,
yeah,
not to involve themselves in foreign wars. And now they're kind of policing the world, and
yeah,
it's a real a degradation of American values, you know, and a disservice to the American military who do honor their oaths of office. So anyway, I hear a beep, so we must be coming to the close.
I think we're
next week, Jim, I'm going to try digging out that book, Hole in One, that you were talking about. And maybe we'll get back to some discussions of consciousness. I'll try to find that book and we'll do a review of that book.
Okay. Great.
Thanks, BBS Radio. Thanks, James Moffat.
Thank you. We'll
be back in 2 weeks' time. My website is at zeropoint.ca. I have some very interesting books, The Heart Doctrine on the Mystical Origins of Consciousness, and my newest book on the Physics of the Secret Doctrine. I do hope to sell some books. I appreciate any donation that can be made through my website. Thank you, BBS, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.